Good morning. It's Friday, August 9th. I'm Gideon Resnick in for Shumita Basu. This is Apple News Today. On today's show, how the pandemic led to a surge in gun sales, why Netflix is facing so many lawsuits, and SNL gets ready for the election. But first, let's check in on the race for the White House. Democratic nominee Kamala Harris and her running mate Minnesota Governor Tim Walz have been met by enthusiastic crowds as they visited swing states this past week. According to their campaign, more than 15,000 people came out to their rally in Detroit and 12,000 to their rally in rural Wisconsin. The Harris campaign has also brought in $310 million in fundraising in July. That's more than double the Trump campaign in that time. And another $36 million in just the first day after Walz joined the ticket. Now, the mood on the Republican side has been very different. With the exception of one planned stop in Montana, a state that is firmly red, Trump has been mostly off the campaign trail this week. Instead, his vice presidential pick, Senator J.D. Vance, has been trailing Harris and Walz from state to state, attempting to counter-program their message. And the Washington Post reports that privately, Trump is growing frustrated.
My big impression is that he is not happy with how this race is going, that he sees Kamala Harris gaining momentum, having larger crowds than Biden ever did, that he sees the polls tightening in a lot of key states, and that he is trying to put himself back at the center of the news.
That's Josh Dossie, who is covering the campaign for The Washington Post. He spoke to me after Trump held a press conference yesterday, where he agreed to a presidential debate to be held by ABC News in September. And also called for two more. Trump also got upset when a reporter asked him about Harris's large crowds.
Oh, give me a break. Listen, I had 107,000 people in New Jersey. You didn't report it.
Dossie says Republicans and the Trump campaign are in a very different place than they were 3 weeks ago at the Republican National Convention, when they were virtually taking a victory lap and even talking about what jobs in the administration people would have. Now Trump is asking some people in his inner circle whether he should make changes to his campaign staff.
He's hearing from all sorts of his friends and donors and others that his campaign has sort of lost altitude right now. So we're in an interesting moment where we're 90 days or so out from the presidency, and we have a dissatisfied candidate by almost all accounts.
As for why Trump has been absent from the campaign trail, Dossie says it's a combination of things. For one, Trump always planned to have a lighter August, and his schedule has not quite yet adjusted since Harris entered the race. Also, since the assassination attempt on his life, the Secret Service has cautioned Trump against holding big events in outdoor spaces. And rallies cost a lot of money.
So, you know, there's a whole host of reasons why he's not campaigning as much right now. But I do think you have a lot of allies who want to see him out there more because of Kamala Harris's more aggressive schedule.
As Dossie reports, Trump is telling friends and allies that the hand he's being dealt isn't fair. As one Trump ally put it to the Post, Trump felt that he had already beaten Biden. Now he needs to recalibrate if he wants to beat Harris too. Let's turn now to a story from Vox, which looks at the drastic rise in gun ownership due to the pandemic. Starting in March 2020, the month the pandemic really took hold in America, and over the course of the next 2 years, one in 20 Americans bought a gun for the first time. And the profile of those first-time gun buyers looked very different from the profile of gun owners that we're used to.
So according to one study, half of them were women, 20% were Black, and 20% were Hispanic.
Vox senior correspondent Maren Kogan asked some of these new gun owners why they got them.
What you saw during the pandemic was that the rise in violent crime and in gun homicide in particular, that violence wasn't felt equally across the U.S. Different communities had a much harder time and faced much more violence than others. And so when I spoke to a number of people who bought their first guns, they were people who were living in communities where they could see the violence rising really dramatically in their own neighborhoods, in their own communities.
Kogan's reporting focused on Chicago, a Democratic stronghold in a state with some of the strictest gun laws in the country. As violence rose in Chicago during the pandemic, some people felt they needed to arm themselves.
So a lot of the gun buying activity, researchers think, and certainly this is backed up by the people I spoke to, was driven by the sense of things are really breaking down here. Crime is on the rise. And I don't know that I can trust the police to get to me in time or to help out if something goes wrong.
And Kogan also found a vicious cycle. When you worry that more people in your community have guns, you then feel the need to arm yourself too.
I talked to multiple people about this who said, if everyone else is going to have a gun, which is what it seems like, because so many people there have guns illegally, they said, if everyone else is going to have one, then I need to have one too.
She spent time talking to people in a concealed carry class on Chicago's South Side. What struck Kogan was that these weren't the type of gun owners that often pop up in policy debates.
No one was like a diehard Second Amendment, these are my rights, you know, and you can pry this gun from my cold, dead hands. No one I spoke to was like that. They were not choosing to get a gun out of ideological or identitarian reasons. They were choosing to get a gun because they didn't feel safe.
While owning a weapon may offer some folks peace of mind, data shows that people who have guns in their homes are more than twice as likely to be shot and killed than people who don't. There's more risk of death by suicides, domestic violence, or accidents. And we should also say that even before this new rush of buyers, America already had more privately owned firearms than the next 25 countries combined. Many gun violence experts now worry about the ripple effect of all these new firearms in homes and the danger they'll present to the owners themselves. TV and movies based on true crime stories are hotter than ever, but they're also getting much harder and much more expensive to make.
With the growth in content in this field, we're also having a growth in legal costs and lawsuits.
Joe Flint is a media reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He says that some of the real people portrayed in Netflix's true crime shows say they aren't being represented fairly. In fact, in the past 5 years, at least 20 defamation suits have been filed in the U.S. against Netflix and its production partners. One of them came from a woman in Scotland who says the hit show Baby Reindeer falsely portrayed her as a stalker and sexual predator. She wasn't named in the show, but internet sleuths found her days after it had aired. She's now suing Netflix for more than $170 million in damages. Now, Netflix says that every episode has a disclaimer saying that some details have been dramatized, and it's looking to dismiss the suit. Other streamers like Hulu and Max have faced similar lawsuits. Flint says that the plaintiffs in these cases face an uphill battle with a high burden of proof. They must prove that they've been harmed by the show and that the creators were negligent in their storytelling.
It takes a lot to win one of these cases, especially in the United States.
Netflix has already won several suits. Some were settled or dismissed. And all of this legal stuff is expensive, but Flint says it's still worth it.
The settlements and legal costs and also increased insurance are sort of a cost of doing business that still probably pale in comparison to the next season of, you know, a big high-priced sci-fi drama.
Which is why Flint says, while all of this is happening behind the scenes, you probably won't notice any difference in content as you're looking through Netflix or other streaming platforms for your next binge watch. Before we let you go, a few other stories being featured in the Apple News app. When Kamala Harris announced Tim Walz as her running mate earlier this week, the domain name, harriswalz.com, had already been taken. And 4 years ago, no less. NPR has the backstory here. Well before anyone could have ever predicted this ticket, a guy in Brooklyn named Jeremy Green Eche had the idea to buy the domain name. He thought up what he called every sort of folksy white man that Harris might pick as a running mate. On his list, J.B. Pritzker, John Fetterman, and yes, Tim Walz. He says that hours after Walz was announced as the pick, he sold harriswalz.com for $15,000 to an anonymous Harris supporter.
It's really fun to register a domain and then have this kind of payoff where I just hit the jackpot and I get a little news cycle. It's just kind of a good time for me.
In another fun election story, Deadline reports that Maya Rudolph is confirmed to reprise her Emmy-winning role as Vice President Kamala Harris on SNL. Here she is playing the part a few years ago.
You call that human rights, China? I call it human wrongs.
Now, we don't know yet who's going to play Tim Walz, but the LA Times reports that SNL's executive producer, Lorne Michaels, called up Steve Martin earlier this week to make him the offer. Martin apparently turned Michaels down, saying, "I was picked because I have gray hair and glasses," but that he is not an impressionist. On the Republican side, James Austin Johnson is expected to return to play Trump, and we don't yet know who will impersonate Vance. And finally, a couple of Olympic stories. First, American track star Noah Lyles competed yesterday in the men's 200 meter and finished with a bronze. After the race, he hunched over on the track and needed to be taken away in a wheelchair. He told NBC he was diagnosed with COVID just 2 days earlier.
It's taken its toll for sure, but I've never been more proud of myself for being able to come out here and getting a bronze medal, where last Olympics I was very disappointed, and this time I couldn't be more proud.
Did you ever consider not running the 200 final?
No, I didn't. I was just saying we were just going to try and quarantine as much as possible, stay away, not trying to, you know, pass it off, and just, to be honest, give it my all.
Also, the U.S. men's basketball team survived a scare against Serbia and staged a late-game rally to win. They will face France for the gold medal this weekend. And before the Olympics comes to a close, it will debut its newest sport, breakdancing. The event is totally improvised. Competitors don't know what music is coming until the DJ plays it. Now, the U.S. is expected to do well in the event. After all, hip-hop culture was born in America. But there's expected to be fierce competition from Japan, the Netherlands, Kazakhstan, and more. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And check out our weekly interview show, In Conversation, where you can hear Shamita's full conversation with former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
I keep saying to them, take back your party. This isn't who you are. The grand old party doing so much for our country and with great leaders in our country. And now, toadies to the sky. What's happened to you?
And if you're listening to the Apple News app right now, that episode is queued up to play for you next. Enjoy the weekend, and we'll be back with the news on Monday.